Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm while she's away on vacation. On Wednesday, President Obama devoted his fourth primetime press conference to health care reform. But yesterday, Senate Democratic leaders conceded they will not meet the president's August deadline for a bipartisan bill. The Dow soars past 9,000 for the first time since January, driven by strong second quarter profit results from some companies. Signs the housing market is stabilizing and layoffs are slowing. Joining me in the studio for the Friday News Roundup are David Wellner of NPR, Laura Meckler of The Wall Street Journal, and Greg Ipp of The Economist. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Good morning.
You can join us, as always, 1-800-433-8850 is our number, drshow@wamu.org, our email address. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Every way you can communicate with us, we want to hear what you have to say. Laura Meckler, important week for the president. One of the headlines this week and one of the big papers said a defining moment. Big primetime press conference. Yesterday goes to Cleveland. Interviews with just about everybody. Don't feel left out. They didn't.
I try not to.
What did this amount to? What did he accomplish this week, you think?
Well, I don't know what he accomplished this week. I certainly know what he tried to accomplish, which was to give what he hopes will be unstoppable momentum towards this healthcare effort. He really is deploying every asset that he has. His political arm is out there campaigning with strong Obama supporters to get them to pressure their members of Congress. He's out there every single day talking about healthcare, as you mentioned, the primetime press conference, and then at my high school, my alma mater, yesterday. So it was a full week of activity for the president, but. What he's hoping is to get the momentum to try. He really wanted to have bills through the House and separately through the Senate before the August recess, before they went home for vacation, so that we would come back in the fall and there would be two bills ready to put together and ready to strike the final deal. We can't get to that final deal until we have bills through each House. And in the end, we found out that no, in fact, the Senate is not going to act before they go home for recess. They have not yet succeeded in putting together a bill. And it's unclear whether the House will act because there's some nervousness there. If the Senate doesn't act, they don't want to go by themselves.
David Wellner, there was a real sense in Washington this week that momentum had slowed about health care. Early in the week, polls showing that the Washington Post, ABC, only 49%, under 50% approve of his handling of health care. The reviews of his press conference, even among reporters who have generally been quite favorable, were really quite critical. Give us your sense of is this correct? Do you think that the momentum has slowed?
Well, I think the fast-track momentum that healthcare had got derailed this week. And that was mainly because the Senate will not be able to do a bill before leaving in August. But I think also a big problem that President Obama has and also that members of Congress have is that there is no health bill right now. People talk about Obama's health plan. He doesn't have a health plan. He has some points that he wants included in a health plan, but it's hard to sell something when you can't say, look, it will do this, this, and this, because they don't know quite what it's going to do yet.
I mean, yesterday, perhaps it was at your former high school, Laura, where he said, let's keep the heat up. But the question is, the heat up on what? And that is not clear at the moment, right?
Well, I actually think there is a more clarity than that to what the health bill is. I think there's a remarkable amount of consensus to the core aspects of the bill, which we could talk about if you'd like. But, you know, there are a lot of things that there's agreement to. And it's more on I would think, comparatively speaking, the margins where, but very important margins, how to pay for it, most importantly, where they have not reached consensus.
But before we get to the details of the bill, Greg Ipp, one of the important dimensions here is one also has a sense that the Republicans believe that the president is weaker. You had Senator Jim DeMint talking about this potentially being the president's Waterloo. You had major Republican commentator Bill Kristol saying moving in for the kill. Do you sense that Republicans now feel that this president, who won election very strongly, very high poll numbers, starting to slow a bit?
I think so. And I think the Republicans are also feeling their oats a bit, because if you go back a few months, they adopted a very similar strategy on the fiscal stimulus, which was, look, we don't have the votes to stop it, so why vote for it? Because then we can always claim that we voted against it when it shows that when we can show that it doesn't work. And that's more or less the strategy they're following now. And I think that they would like to do something similar with health care. What is perhaps more politically treacherous for the president is the uneasiness that the conservative members of his own party are beginning to feel. Last week, you know, I think the shocker was how many of the conservative Blue Dog Democrats voted against in committee the House version of that bill. And what they are, in some sense, feeling is a growing unease out in the population as well about both the deficit and the extent of the possible tax increases necessary to pay for this.
Well, now, you mentioned, Greg, that the possibility of tax increases, one of the key sticking points, particularly among these, you mentioned Blue Dog Democrats, many of them in their first or second term, many of them high on the Republican hit list for the election coming up next year. And so they're talking not just about economics, but about political survival.
Yes. In fact, for example, Congressman Paulus of Colorado, people like this, they're exercised about this because of the possible impact of much higher marginal tax rates, both on the affluent families in their districts, but also on small business. And you can be very sure that the Republicans will make a big issue of that if higher taxes on small business and individuals are a big part of how this is paid for.
And David, what else do you see as major sticking points? You pointed out that the bill is still in the process of being crystallized. In addition to how to pay for it, particularly in terms of taxes, what else is really the major obstacles
here? Well, I would add, in terms of how to pay for it, the whole question about whether health plans should be taxed and whether there should be an exclusion for them or not. Max Baucus, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, still favors that kind of taxation. And his committee has yet to come out with what they call a mark, something that they will try to amend. He says they'll have that done by the time they leave in August. That would mean that you would have two Senate health plans. The HELP committee came out with its own much more liberal plan to reconcile during August. And then the House has two plans approved so far, or two committees have approved the plan, but they also have another committee that still has to approve a plan. And that's where the devil is in the details here. One of the problems is that the Congressional Budget Office Director Doug Elmendorf last week said that unfortunately these plans do not bend the cost curve down sufficiently in coming years. And they have yet to come up with something that would convince at least lawmakers that would do it.
Well, this has two important implications, Laura. One is for the balance sheet. You know, that is, how do you claim you're paying for it? And the president in his press conference said that two-thirds of the money, the pay for, as he put it, would come from squeezing efficiencies or inefficiencies out of the system. And one of the issues, the buzzword in Washington this week, is this word MedPAC, which is a new idea to try to make Medicare much more efficient. Explain that.
Yes. Well, it's important to understand there are fundamentally two issues here. One is how to pay for the bill and make sure it doesn't add to the deficit. And the other is how to change the healthcare system long term so we control healthcare spending. Mm-hmm. Those are actually two separate but related issues. The MedPAC idea is there already is a commission called MedPAC. What they do is they make recommendations for sometimes cutting provider payments, for making changes to how Medicare reimburses people to try to reimburses doctors and hospitals to try to have them run more efficiently. There are all sorts of ideas that MedPAC, it's a group of experts, comes up with, and they're usually ignored by Congress. So the idea behind the administration's proposal, which they're pushing very hard, is...
But it's also a favorite of the Blue Dog Democrat,
exactly.
Greg was talking
about. This
is
something that the Blue Dogs like, and unfortunately many other members of Congress do not like, unfortunate for the people pushing it, which is that what this would do is it would sort of transform MedPAC into what they call MedPAC on steroids, or a administration agency that would be able to make these recommendations, and they would take effect unless Congress stopped them.
The model here, of course, is a base closing commission.
That's one of the models,
And the argument being that unless you have an independent commission, Congress will always mess with the formulas and you won't really save the money.
And what happens now is Congress either messes with the formulas or they just ignore it altogether. And so what the idea behind this is, if you have a more structural system where these recommendations could take effect without, unless Congress actually actively stops it, which is harder, much harder to do, then that would go a long way, the Blue Dogs believe, the administration believe, to get control of long-term spending.
Greg, another very important part of this. is the question of whether the president and some of his allies on Capitol Hill will be able to attract Republican votes. The president has said repeatedly he prefers what he calls a bipartisan solution. Senator Baucus, head of the Finance Committee, continues to talk to some Republicans, Senator Grassley from Iowa, Senator Snow from Maine, even Senator Enzi from Wyoming. What at this point is your best guess? Will there be a possibility of Republican support, or is this going to wind up being just a Democratic bill?
That is such a tough question right now. I mean, the best argument in favor of saying, yes, it will be bipartisan is the extraordinary lengths that Max Baucus, the chairman of the Finance Committee, is going to get a few moderate Republicans and, most importantly, Chuck Grassley, the ranking member on his committee, to sign on to this. And that's why it's taking so long for that committee to produce a bill. And my guess is that in order to succeed and to get those moderate Republicans on board, they're going to have to sacrifice something in terms of coverage, not getting all the way to 97% of all Americans with insurance, in order to reduce the amount of money they have to raise through higher taxes. The question then becomes, is that acceptable to the House and to the more liberal members of the president's party?
Well, this is a very big question, because there is pressure from the president to reach out to Republicans, but there is pressure from the liberal wing of the Democratic Party to say the price is too high. We'll have to water down the bill too much. Let's just go with an all-Democratic bill.
And when push comes to shove, that's probably what will happen. Look, to allow this reform effort to fail right now would be a serious, serious blow to Obama's administration and to the Democratic Party. And they all know that. And if they had to choose between that and bipartisanship, I think we know what they'd choose.
Quick, David, what's your take on the prospects for bipartisanship?
Well, Chuck Grassley told me that he would stick with this bill in the Finance Committee as long as he felt that it was bipartisan. But he said the minute he feels it isn't, he's going to bail out. And the prospect is that that is going to happen. I could see him voting for the Finance Committee bill, but then that bill is going to have to be reconciled with the more liberal House bill. And the House bill that's even more liberal. That finance bill is going to have to become more liberal.
David Welnut, Laura Meckler, Greg Ipp. I'm Steve Roberts. We're going to be back with your calls, your questions, more conversations. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane and our first hour of the Friday morning news roundup, focusing on domestic issues. Greg Ipp is with me from The Economist, Laura Meckler of The Wall Street Journal, David Welnut of NPR. 1-800-433-8850 is our number. drshow@wamu.org is our email address. Greg Ipp, this whole debate we've been talking about is in a context of economic recovery, such as it is, or at least a slowing of the recession. Mixed signals this week. Dow tops 9,000, although this morning it's down a bit, about 60 points as we're speaking. Some good earnings reports, but some negative earnings report. Microsoft way down. Give us an update on where the economy seems to be right now.
I think the economy is slowly slouching towards recovery here. I think there's very good bet that when we look back, we'll have concluded that the recession ended right around now. Now, the recession ending is quite different from saying a strong recovery is in place. We still do not have growth numbers out there that are anywhere near strong enough to put the people back to work who are losing their jobs now. The unemployment rate is probably going to continue going up for a few more months at least. But the news on Wall Street's good. What you've had is the Dow rallying, not necessarily because companies are making money hand over fist, but because they're not losing as much money as people had feared. If you look at what Ford said, for example, if you cut away all the accounting stuff, they still lost about $1 billion making cars in the second quarter. But it wasn't as much money as some people thought they would lose. So those sorts of things matter, and they've added an element of optimism, I think, that was absent some months ago.
Now, Laura, Ben Bernanke, the head of the Fed, was on Capitol Hill this week, made news in several ways, but he talked about this jobless recovery. And this continues to be a source of enormous concern to the administration, but also to average Americans, because unemployment at 9.5, the projections still are it was going to top 10% before it turns around. What did Bernanke say about this, and why is it that the jobless numbers seem to always trail any signs of recovery?
Right. Well, that exactly is right. That Bernanke's testimony really was kind of mixed message in terms of politically and how regular Americans are greeting the economy right now. The idea behind a jobless recovery is that, you know, even after companies start to recover and start to make a little bit of money, they're not really ready to start hiring in great numbers right away. And so you still end up with high unemployment. And the result of that is that for everyday Americans who are looking at their situations, looking at their own personal efforts to find jobs, looking at their friends and neighbors, it doesn't really feel much like a recovery.
And if it doesn't feel much like a recovery, then people don't spend.
Right. And then if people don't spend, obviously that fails to continue to stimulate the economy even more. So you really do need people to start being hired and have those unemployment numbers drop by some significant number before I think people are going to feel like we're out of the woods.
And there's also an important political and all these stories tie together, David, because the Republicans have now taken up, you know, the jobless numbers to say, see, President Obama's stimulus package didn't work for you ordinary Americans. Why would you trust him on health care? So they are trying to use this jobless recovery to draw down some of the confidence in Obama on health care.
Right. Well, I think it's hard for Democrats to make the argument, well, you know, jobs are a lagging indicator, and so just hang in there. I mean, people see palpably that you know, unemployment lines are still very long. And, I mean, I think by reminding people, Democrats can remind people that in fact, things could have been much worse than they are right now. That's one argument they can make. Still, you know, what people really see is the reality out there on the streets. And I think Republicans are grabbing this as something that at least they're not proposing any great alternatives, but they're saying be wary of any new proposals from this administration since you haven't seen the results that you expected from the last thing.
And Greg, one of the fallouts of this recession felt not just here in Washington, but around state capitals, particularly in Sacramento, where the state legislature in California has been struggling with a $26 billion budget shortfall. Just there's news this morning that one house of the legislature has passed this package of recovery bills, but mainly because states cannot do what the federal government does. They can't keep borrowing, and you've been writing this week about the importance of the deficit. You can't do that in California, and therefore the impact of this new budget on state services is going to be very severe.
That's right. As the federal government giveth, the states taketh away. The California news was pretty grim going into this, and it's good news that they do appear to have a deal. The legislature is voting on it this week and perhaps next week. But what's interesting, Steve, is that California's numbers are big, but relative to the size of the economy, they're not exceptional. If you go across the country, almost every state is running shortfalls that are almost as big, in some cases bigger than California's. Now, not many states, if any, have the dysfunctional politics that California does, so you don't get the high drama that you do in Sacramento at moments like this. But I've seen numbers that the collective budget shortfall of all the states in the coming year is going to be on the order of $100 to $150 billion. And as you said, most states' constitutions do not permit them to run deficits, and so you are going to see a lot of what you just saw in California: cuts to higher education, cuts to health care, more furloughs, more accounting gimmicks weeks to try and get around that. Now, interestingly, yes, those kinds of cuts are going to work against the economic recovery. And they actually make the case for the stimulus package that the president got through Congress stronger than ever, because there's no question that in the absence of the extra money being pumped in the economy by that federal stimulus, both directly and via the states, things would be much worse. And so it's highly disingenuous, actually, of the Republicans to argue that the fact that unemployment is still high shows that it's not working. Based on economics alone, it's a sure bet that the numbers would be worse.
But it is a very hard political argument to make. It would have been worse if we hadn't acted, because the pain is greater. You just look at California. Just take the example of the higher education system, which has been a jewel of California. One of the great elements of the California dream has always been high-quality, low-cost public education. And this budget is really going to damage that.
Yeah, yes, it will. And interestingly, we had a feature recently that compared California to Texas, where people in Texas are actually kind of feeling pretty good because their financial and economic situation is not nearly as bad as California's. Of course, in Texas, they say, well, the thing that we don't have, that California does have, is a first-class higher education system. And so they would have to be wondering, how do we try and get to that high-class education system without inheriting the budget problems that
Laura, another news story about the economy this week related to the minimum wage, and this was, of course, anticipated. Minimum wage went up this week by statute from $6.55 an hour to $7.25. But it triggered an interesting debate about whether this helps or hurts the economy. There are strong feelings on both sides.
That's true. On one hand, I think it may take effect today, actually. On one hand, the argument is if you give low-wage workers more money, they will spend it. They need to spend it, and they will, and that will help the economy.
And that's what you want out of a stimulus package.
Right. And that's what people who support a higher minimum wage, an argument that's often made. On the other hand, though, there are some people who say, well, raising the minimum wage maybe in general is a good idea, but at this moment, these businesses who are paying minimum wage to their workers really can't afford it. And the result is going to be that, sure, they're going to have to raise the pay of the people who are there, but they may cut back on hours, or they may lay one person off.
Or not hire a new person.
We're talking about
the jobless economy we're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. So, I mean, how that plays out, whether it's a net negative or a net positive, you know, I don't know. But it certainly is a debate. And what we'll find out.
Another whole series of news stories that I want to get to, David, and you on Capitol Hill covered this week. Talking about the economy and government savings, there was an important vote on the budget line of the F-22 fighters. And this is a favorite fighter of the Air Force. Strong congressional support for it, in part because parts are made in about 44 different states. The home senator, Saxby Chambliss of Georgia, home headquarters of Lockheed Martin, the main contractor, lobbied very strongly, and Congress voted to cut this money out. Significance of this vote, what happened?
This was a real test of wills between Defense Secretary Gates, who wants to restructure the Pentagon and make it more cost-efficient, more attuned to the new wars that this country faces, and sort of the economic interests across the country, and what John McCain several times called the military-industrial complex. And there was tremendous pushback. In the Armed Services Committee, they approved by a one-vote margin adding seven F-22s that Secretary Gates said were not needed. And President Obama issued his first veto threat against the entire defense authorization bill for $680 billion over this $1.75 billion seven-plane order. He, in the end, prevailed. It was a 58-40 vote when it came down to it on Tuesday. And just a week earlier, it looked like they would lose on the amendment that would strip out that money. So symbolically, it was a big win. How much money was actually saved for the country, I'm not sure.
Well, but also it was important politically, Laura. I mean, we've been talking about health care and how the stakes for the president are very high, because if you lose this one, it makes you appear vulnerable. And this was another example. When you issue a veto threat, you're rolling the dice here, and this was an important moment for him.
Absolutely. The White House was very quick to trumpet it after that vote happened. And I think it relates to health care in another way, which is that the president is, you know, making very clear this will not add to the deficit. He wants the message that he cares about the deficit. There are polls show there's rising concern about the deficit. And so anything that happens that can show that they're taking the federal purse seriously and they're not just spending is helpful. So maybe $1.75 billion isn't a lot to people who actually look at the full budget and see that it, you know, truly is a rounding error. It doesn't matter. It's very important symbolically.
And it's also important symbolically because it came in a week when Secretary Gates talked about raising like 22,000 the number of active duty troops. And that highlighted the point that Gates has been making, is that to some extent the defense budget's a zero-sum game and that we have to move money around to meet the more direct threats that we're facing as a country.
That's true. And it really was Secretary Gates' credibility up there as well as President mm-hmm. Obama's credibility. And I think the point you made earlier about the fact that if you defeat someone on one thing, it's easier to defeat you on the next thing is very important.
And of course, Gates is a Republican, a holdover from the Bush administration.
Right.
And one of the reasons we see, can see one of the reasons why he was retained was for just a vote like this.
Absolutely.
He gets a lot of credibility.
And he also is trying to do, he has a big agenda, obviously, a lot on his plate, but he's trying to do, as David mentioned, procurement reform, where they would try to really restructure the whole way the Pentagon does business and how it acquires systems. So if he couldn't get this one, which Republicans and Democrats, previous administration and the current one, all agreed wasn't necessary, then how could he possibly get anything else?
Now, Greg Gipp, another issue that the president dealt with at his press conference was the issue of race and the issue of the arrest of a prominent Harvard professor, Henry Louis Gates Jr. Before I ask you about that, I have to say, I'm Steve Roberts, and we're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. So, Greg, at the end of his press conference, he was asked about this incident, and he gave a strong answer. What did he say, and what's been the fallout from his answer?
The answer is very interesting, Steve. He said, first of all, he didn't know the facts of the case, and he said, second of all, he's a friend of Gates. But he said that it looked like the police in this case had behaved stupidly by arresting a person that they knew at by that point was in his own home. And he then went on to say that quite apart from the facts of this case, it is just a fact that people of color, African Americans, Hispanics, Latinos, are disproportionately arrested in this country. I thought it was a very interesting and a carefully balanced response in the following way, that by acknowledging, you know, the feelings of anger of many of those minority communities because this incident felt so familiar to them, he made it clear that those were legitimate feelings, but he also carefully separated that issue from the facts of this case. Now, it's an open question whether, as this debate continues, people will see or give him credit for his effort to try and keep those things separate.
Well, this fits in a context of how this first African-American president has always approached race. He has tried to both reflect these feelings on the part of blacks. He said at the press conference, race still haunts us. He has not tried to say everything's fine because you have a black president. But he's never been the voice of black grievance. He's never been Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson. He's tried to strike a very careful balance on this.
Yes, and also it was he never misses the opportunity to point out the fact that he himself is there in the White House is a pretty profound statement about how far we've come on this issue in this country.
Laura, you at the White House, your take on and also the aftermath, because the white policeman, Sergeant Crowley, said, I'm not going to apologize, and he's been rather strong in pushing back.
I actually thought that, unlike most of what we hear from the president, which is very carefully scripted and carefully balanced, that this was maybe there was balance to the answer, but this struck me as a much more of him just answering the question as he actually thought the answer was, and a little less calculated. I think if he was being more calculated, he may not have said that they acted stupidly. He did get a couple of the facts wrong in the case. And in fact, he has had to now answer, instead of it being his answer being viewed as in the context that you just mentioned, which is how he carefully balances the issues of race, which I do think he tries to do. Now he's having to defend the fact that he's taken sides against an officer who says, hey, I did nothing wrong. This professor was, you know, ranting and raving at me and I warned him. And so I arrested him. And, you know, I certainly would not profess to know who is right here. I think that the commentary that Obama gave was very important and interesting, but he muddled it a little bit by taking sides and coming down against one particular police officer.
And David, he was also speaking from his own history, not only as a black man in America, but as someone who has focused on racial profiling as an issue. He went out of his way to point out that when he was in the Illinois legislature, this was an important issue to him. He was a sponsor of legislation. And he said, it's a fact that blacks and Latinos, he was careful to include Latinos in his statement, do suffer from this. And so that is part of the dimension here, too.
And the great irony is that Officer Crowley, who arrested him, is in charge of the racial profiling training program for the Cambridge Police. He himself is somebody who should have been keenly aware of these issues. And the question is, are they going to do things differently from now on?
We only have another minute, Greg. This is obviously part of a larger ongoing conversation in this country about race, but one of the other dimensions that was raised was the treatment of Muslims and Arab Americans in the wake of 9/11, that the racial profiling is not just an issue for blacks and not just an issue for Latinos, but that also has come into the conversation as a result of this incident.
Yeah, I think that is the case, and it's going to continue to be an issue that the president will have to be struggling with, trying to strike that balance every time this issue comes up.
And between the balance of adequately protecting the country against terrorism and yet dealing honestly and fairly with individuals who might have a certain name or look a certain way.
Yeah.
Okay, that's Greg Ipp. And also with me, Greg is with The Economist, David Wellner of NPR, Laura Meckler of The Wall Street Journal. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and we're going to get to your emails and your calls as soon as we come back, so stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup, President Obama tells Prime Minister al-Maliki the U.S. will push to lift U.N. sanctions imposed against Iraq. Secretary of State Clinton meets with Southeast Asian nations. And Vice President Biden goes to Georgia and Ukraine. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane while she's away on vacation. And this hour of our Friday News Roundup, with me are Greg Ipp of The Economist, Laura Meckler of The Wall Street Journal, David Wellner of NPR. And let me read a couple of emails. This one says, my Republican representative said in an interview on a local TV station that he would not vote for the health care bill because it would fund abortions at taxpayer expense. Our representatives, senators, judges, administration, staff, et cetera, receive health care benefits paid by taxpayers. If they or someone in their families wanted an abortion, would their taxpayer-funded health care coverage pay for it? I'm hoping that you or one of your guests knows the answer. Laura, answer this email and also this larger question of this role abortion is playing in this.
Right. This is abortion. You can never get away from it when you're dealing with health care on any level. It always comes back. basically, it's a side issue, but it's one that will definitely take up some attention. The question is whether people who get subsidies through this new exchange will be able to buy a health coverage plan, a health insurance plan that includes abortion services. People who support abortion rights, most Democrats, would like to have this issue not resolved in legislation, just have this be something that is set by the insurance companies. And the de facto would probably be that it would be covered, because usually in the private market it is. But people who are very strongly against abortion in the Congress, and that includes both many Republicans as well as some conservative Democrats, are saying that, no, we're not going to just let it go to work out as it is. We're going to offer amendments, and we're going to make us vote on this and say to specifically ban the use of any taxpayer money towards a health insurance plan that would include abortion. That is the policy for many other federal programs right now. For instance, in Medicaid, you cannot use Medicaid, will not pay for abortions. You cannot get an abortion on a military base if you're serving mm-hmm. in the military. Generally speaking, we do not allow a taxpayer money to pay for abortion in any way. So the question becomes, in this case, when you're buying a private plan but you're getting a little bit of government help to do it, does that count? And I can assure you that this bill is not going to end up in the Rose Garden before this issue is dealt with.
Let's read this email from John in Detroit. Greg, the unemployment numbers are based on states reporting the number of those applying for and collecting unemployment. But if you max out on your benefits, even the extension, and you're still unemployed, you're lost in the official count. And this applies to hundreds of thousands of people, especially here in Michigan, so the current numbers are bogus. Talk about this, because this is an important question. It's not just you're not counted. There are the people who are furloughed, people who are underemployed, people who are working fewer hours. Talk about that.
Well, as far as the numbers go, it's not actually quite correct to say that if you run out of your unemployment benefits, you're not counted mm-hmm. as unemployed. When the government tries to measure who's unemployed, they don't ask you, are you getting benefits? They just ask you, are you unemployed and still looking for work? Mm-hmm. That said, the official unemployment number of around 9.5% probably does significantly understate just how much stress there is out there in the job market for a number of reasons. There are people who have just given up looking for work, and so they don't even answer the question, are you looking for work? They say no. There's no jobs out there. There are people who have involuntarily taken cuts to their hours. They're only working 30 or 20 hours a week when they'd like to be working 40. Those people are not captured in the unemployment numbers. And then to a striking degree, in this recession, we've seen companies cutting the pay or freezing the pay of people. Out in California, we were discussing this just a few minutes ago, hundreds of thousands of employees potentially affected by furloughs, which is fine for some, but really hurting the ability of others to meet their mortgage payments.
And this relates to something that Laura was talking earlier about, the jobless recover, and why one of the factors here is companies that are have cut hours or furloughed people, the first thing they're going to do is boost back hours before they hire new employees and accrue new benefits. So there's a softness in the employment picture that is going to have to harden up before these numbers look better.
Right, and that's why people are so concerned that this is going to take a while before, as Greg said earlier, we may look back and say that right now is when the recession ended, but it's not going to feel that way.
Let's turn to Eric in Mystic, Connecticut. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Oh, thank you so much. I just wanted to make two quick comments, if I could. The first one is about Dr. Henry Louis Gates' mm-hmm. arrest. I believe that President Obama made a mistake in weighing in. I think he probably could have said, you know, this news conference is about health care. I'd like to stick to that. But if he did, he tried to weigh in carefully, but I think he made the mistake when he used the words behaved stupidly. Being an African-American, I pretty much know that if there would have been an older white gentleman at that door trying to force his way in, someone saw him walking by, or someone walking by would not have made a 911 phone call. But I just think he should have not used those words, because he didn't have all the facts, and both of those guys probably acted inappropriately at some point during that exchange, but we'll never know. But the second point is about the Republicans and their party of no approach to the health care reform. It's very frustrating and deplorable that they're taking the stance that we'll just kill this, as opposed to actually trying to find a real solution. And the reason that they don't care is because they're representing probably people who are doing the talking already have health care, so they don't understand what it's like not to have health care. And we have a sense of entitlement in this country for our years of prosperity, that everything should be given to us. And then if we don't have the money to pay for it, we'll just charge it. They didn't have any problem to pass the prescription drug act over the 8 years and take a surplus and turn it into a deficit. But now all of a sudden they're so morally conscious about the deficit and how much this is going to cost for something very important. So.
Thank you very much, Eric. We appreciate it. David Wellner.
Yes, in fact, Steny Hoyer, the House Majority Leader, made that very point after Republicans, one after another, went to the floor and decried the jobless situation. He said, well, wait a minute. We're trying to pay for health care, unlike when you passed this prescription drugs benefit and it wasn't paid for at all and you blew a great big hole in the budget. We're trying to act responsibly. And I think that that's something Democrats are going to be saying over and over again with the health care plan. The problem is that they still don't have quite a scheme worked out where they all agree on how they're going to pay for it.
And, Greg, you've written a lot about the deficit. And one of the things that the president keeps saying, said it again this week, you got to remember, we inherited a $1 trillion deficit. But at some point, his ability to blame everything on the previous administration starts to diminish.
Yeah, it really doesn't seem very fair, does it? I mean, one of the reasons the Republicans and Bush were able to enact these very expensive programs without paying for them was that they inherited a surplus from Bill Clinton. Obama comes in and he inherits not only a deficit, but a deficit that was on its way to becoming much, much worse because of the depth of the recession. And so he comes out with a health care plan, and he has been adamant that that will not add to the deficit. But unfortunately, given the situation he inherited and that has gotten so much worse, any reform that merely doesn't add to the deficit is probably, from a long-term point of view, not good enough. It's got to put that deficit on a very pronounced downward path over the next few decades.
Let's turn to Karen in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Karen.
Well, thank you. I wanted to say that I think it makes a lot of sense to tax the health care benefits for those people who are lucky enough to be working for large companies that give them generous benefits. If they got a Christmas bonus or if they got free use of the company card, they'd have to recognize it as income. And the health care benefits just another goodie they get, and it should be taxed. And the person who doesn't have their employer providing health care, and they have to pay for their own health care insurance or whatever, they have to do it with after-tax dollars.
Right. Thank you, Karen. Thank you very much. Laura Meckler, deal with this very important issue, Karen. Right,
this is an important issue, and there's another argument for taxing health care benefits, too, which is that if you tax them, then you take away the incentive that currently exists to give people very, very generous benefits. And when people have very generous benefits, it means it costs them less out of pocket to use medical services. Now, that may sound like a good idea if you're the one getting the benefit, but from a macro health economy point of view, you don't really want people overusing medical services. So a lot of people, including the director of the Congressional Budget Office, says, hey, if you want to stem the long-term costs in healthcare, one of the ways to do it is to tax employee benefits.
But
politically, you know, it's very difficult.
Particularly, you know, the president talks about the special interests who are against reform, but one of the special interests, very important special interests, are the unions,
right,
who are the strongest supporters or the strongest opponents of taxing these benefits because they often have the best health care.
And many of them make less than $250,000 a year, and Obama promised in his campaign nobody earning less than that would see their taxes go up. And so it's a very difficult political problem. Yes, unions are saying, hey, we gave up raises in order to get better health care benefits, and now you're going to tax them. But as David said earlier, Max Baucus is very interested in this idea. It's become very problematic politically. But I think it still remains in the mix until they figure out a way to fund this bill. I think it will still be at least on the table somewhere.
Let's turn to Chris in West Palm Beach, Florida. Chris, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks. I'm wondering, does anyone on your panel have an idea why President Obama in his town hall meeting yesterday and his primetime news conference the night before, why he hasn't mentioned, there was no mention of a public option?
David Wellner, I thought he has been talking about the public option this week, but go ahead.
He has clearly endorsed the idea of a public option, but I think that there is a debate still going on in Congress about quite what that would be. Max Baucus in the Finance Committee favors a nonprofit cooperative healthcare system as an alternative to a public option.
And so does Senator Grassley.
Absolutely. And that's attractive to a certain number of lawmakers, but many others are skeptical of the idea, saying that it would not be effective enough to force the private plans to become more efficient.
And just one other interesting thing about this is that the White House has an interesting balance to try to walk, because they want to keep people, probably like the caller, happy, believing that they are, in fact, supporting a strong public option, which they do support a strong public option, but at the same time encourage these bipartisan talks, which are not going to likely produce a strong public option.
Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska, who is a Democrat, has said that a public plan is a deal breaker for him. So that's an issue that President Obama is dealing
with.
But
this discussion reinforces a point we were talking about earlier, which when the president campaigns, as he has this week, for his plan, there are still so many undecided questions, so many moving parts, that it's hard to galvanize support for a plan that is still so uncrystallized.
Well, but they are, in fact, working to try to galvanize support. And one of the ways they're doing it, actually, in general, is talking about the public plan, even though he didn't mention it yesterday.
Let's turn to Stan in Dallas, Texas. Welcome, Stan. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Good.
One comment that no Republicans support national health care reform. There's a Wyden-Bennett bill that actually insures all Americans, does it for less costs than we're spending today, and there are 9 Republicans signed on to that. Also, Senator Coburn and Burr have a plan to at least have affordable health care for all Americans. But my question is, there are 2 budgets that we really need to pay attention to. One is the federal budget, all federal expenditures for health care. And Obama's really focused on that to his credit, but there's also a national health expenditure, and that includes all things like my coverage, which is a group health insurance through my employer, and there's 150 million Americans that are in that portion. So as I look at what the Democrats and President are proposing, they're going to decrease fees to doctors and hospitals through Medicare. I think that's in the bills. And that will be cost-shifted over to my premiums. Also, they're going to increase the rolls of Medicaid by putting millions of more people on the Medicaid rolls, and Medicaid pays below the cost of doing business for hospitals and doctors. So they will cost-shift that to my premium. So
thanks a lot, Stan. We really appreciate it. Greg Gipp, deal with Stan's point about not only the role of Republicans, but this question of 150, 160 million Americans who have private health care are going to feel an impact from this.
It's a political and an economic challenge. The political challenge is that the fact of the matter is the majority of Americans still have insurance coverage and are happy with it. And so trying to solve this problem without actually scaring those people into thinking they're losing something that they like is one of the big challenges. Now, on the economics of it, and to Obama's credit, one of the points that he's tried to make is that even if you have coverage that you like, you're in danger of losing it because costs are out of control. And one of the benefits this reform might have is to change the way, for example, Medicare is paid for in a way that spills over to the way private care is provided. So not only do we get the public health care bill down, we also get down the private health care bill, which is crippling so many families and businesses.
I'm Steve Roberts. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. This is an absolutely critical question here. I mean, we've been talking about it all morning in one form or another, David, part of what President Obama tried to do this week is speak to callers like Stan, who have private insurance, but he's trying to say, look, your situation is going to get worse. Your premiums are going to go up. It's going to have an effect on your wages. You could maybe lose health insurance. This is a critical political question. We convince listeners like Stan that they have a vested interest in this fight.
Well, President Obama says, the problem is that for many people, the devil they know is preferable to the devil they don't know. So many people don't trust the idea that healthcare would necessarily come down in price with this reform that's being carried out. I think what's really key in all of this is that most healthcare is delivered right now on a fee-for-service basis, and that provides a perverse incentive to prescribe more and more procedures because the doctor is paid by how many procedures are done. And you have alternative examples such as the Mayo Clinic or the Geisinger Health Plan, where the doctors are paid salaries, and it's in their interest to have good outcomes so their patients don't have to use a lot of these procedures. I think that the key is going to be using Medicare to be a model for shifting to that kind of an outcome-based system, and that could bring down costs across the board.
We have time for maybe one more caller. So, John in Grants Pass, Oregon, you've been waiting patiently. We appreciate it. Welcome.
Steve, we need health care, but Congress is only going to offer health insurance As long as politicians get their share of the 34% the insurance companies add to the cost of our health care. You just mentioned in Medicare, the nation of Taiwan based their excellent coverage on the U.S. Medicare model. They pay one-seventh of our cost per capita. They have excellent universal health care coverage. Next time you hear somebody ranting about how bad Canada is, ask, why won't they talk about Taiwan's system?
John, thanks very much. Please go ahead. We have just a minute.
I'm not familiar with Taiwan's system, I will confess, but it sounds like what the caller is talking about is more of a single-payer system, which a lot of liberals would want, which is where you just basically have the government pays all the bills and no private insurance companies. Putting aside the merits or detractions of that approach, there just really is not enough political support for that to happen. And even the most liberal Democrats have accepted that, and that's why they're pushing so hard for the public plan as an alternative a choice within this new health insurance exchange. It's sort of the next best thing from their point of view.
That's going to have to be the last word. Laura Meckler is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, covers health care from the White House. David Wellner, congressional correspondent, National Public Radio, familiar voice to many of you. And Greg Ipp, he's the U.S. economics editor of The Economist. Thanks so much for all of you for joining us here on The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Steve Roberts. I've been sitting in for Diane while she's away on vacation. And thanks so much for spending part of your morning with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.